Welcome back, everybody, to What Really Matters. I'm Tablet Deputy Editor Jeremy Stern with you in Los Angeles. I'm here, as always, with Walter Russell Mead, Tablet news writer, Global View columnist at The Wall Street Journal, and distinguished fellow at Hudson. Let's start with this week's news. First story of the week. President Biden has long vowed to build 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations in the United States by 2030. Those stations, the White House said, would help Americans feel confident purchasing and driving electric cars and help the country cut carbon pollution. But now, more than 2 years after Congress allocated $7.5 billion to help build out those stations, only seven EV charging stations are operational across four states, according to the Washington Post. And as the Biden administration rolls out its new rules for emissions from cars and trucks, which will require a lot more electric cars and hybrids on the road, the sluggish build-out could slow the transition to electric cars. Walter, is this news or faux news?
I'm afraid it's news. The dogs don't like the dog food seems to be the problem that the whole EV industry is facing right now. And you have to say it was kind of an intelligent political strategy overall that the sort of green lobbies decided that, you know, pushing electric cars is really the way to go. And the way to do that is if you convince industry that governments are going to make everybody buy an EV, whether they want it or not, then the industries are going to invest a lot of money in EV production lines. And once they've done that, the industry is going to be insanely bent on lobbying to force everyone to buy them. And it's not that hard of a sell for a lot of car companies. You know, basically saying everybody in the world has to buy a new car is not the worst thing that anybody's ever done to the automobile industry. And we'll give them tax credits to help them do it. So that's the idea. And the only problem is that people don't seem to want to buy them, at least not enough people do. And we've seen Tesla is having problems. We're seeing that this business with the charging stations is just kind of making it worse. Now, I don't want to be like, okay, EVs are over, ha ha ha, because in fact, you know, the news today that some Chinese companies have come up with some interesting new batteries that are longer lasting, which would solve one of the problems. But there are all kinds of little issues that are popping up, you know, like EVs are supposed to be cheaper to repair because they have fewer parts. But on the other hand, it means that even a small dent can force you to replace huge chunks of the inner part of the car. So yes, there are fewer parts, but repairs can still cost more money. And then the other part of it is, frankly, gas-powered cars have been getting a lot better in recent years. You know, certainly when I was a kid, you thought you were in pretty good shape if you got 75,000 miles off of a Detroit car. Now that's just the beginning, you know, 100, 200,000 miles and more. So what's happening is that this enormous push that's committed hundreds of billions of dollars in financing and large car companies betting their future on it are running into a wall. The next piece of the wall is likely to be China believing that, in fact, we would do what we were doing, has prepared itself to take over the EV market and is actually producing cars that seem to be significantly better than Teslas and cheaper than Teslas. My guess is that we're going to see in Europe and the US a wave of tariffs to keep cheap EVs out. In fact, I see Janet Yellen is in China now, and one of her agenda items is to beg the Chinese to stop flooding the world with cheap green products due to overcapacity in China. So our policymaking has reached a point of maximum incoherence. There's consumer resistance to the whole idea. This is news. And they can't seem to get the chargers fixed, which we can't get our aircraft carriers built on time. We can't repair things quickly. This is part of a generalized incompetence in American government and to some degree American business. Some of it is self-inflicted. This is not faux news at all. This is a little tip of an iceberg that tells us there's a much bigger problem right below the surface.
It does remind me of some recent stories about the various subsidies in the CHIPS Act, which is one of the administration's other main domestic legislative achievements, being held up or not disseminated yet, or even primarily just going to Intel at just the moment that it looks like Intel might have lost the generational chip battle to NVIDIA. At this point, how do you grade the current performance of America's new vaunted industrial policy?
So far, not so great. I would say it's not a total failure in the sense that if President Biden has anything going for him in the election other than people's concerns about his opponent, Donald Trump, it is that the economy is doing pretty well. And some of that is clearly a result of just a lot of spending. Like, we may not be building a lot of charging stations or a lot of chip plants, but we're spending a lot of money. And when that happens, the economy can tend to kind of roll on. People get jobs and so on. So it may not be reinvigorating the United States, but it is helping to keep the Biden administration in the battle for reelection. And that, one can assume, was at least part of the ambition behind the bills.
All right, our second story. Israeli airstrikes near the Iranian embassy in Damascus, including an Iranian consular building, killed at least 7 Revolutionary Guard Corps officers, including Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a senior commander in the Quds Force who was meeting with senior leaders of Palestinian Islamic Jihad. On the same day, a series of IDF drone strikes killed 7 international aid workers in Gaza who were working for World Central Kitchen. The aid worker incident has provoked a wave of international condemnation of Israel. And just before recording, it was reported that Biden told Bibi in a phone call that he was going to demand an immediate ceasefire. We'll see what happens with that. And in the meantime, the Biden administration has also informed the Iranian government that it had, quote, no involvement or advanced knowledge of the IDF strikes in Syria. So, Walter, are these strikes news or faux news?
I would say, actually, of the two strikes, the one in Damascus is much more important than the very unfortunate incident in Gaza. You hear from some of the sort of usual anti-Israel sources, oh my gosh, it's obviously they're deliberately attacking aid workers because they want to starve people. It's very hard for me to figure out a picture of Israeli interests that would make, you know, that this was obviously something they did not want to happen. Now, whether they were taking reasonable steps and just had some really bad luck, or whether they really, really need stronger procedures, I can't tell you. But ultimately, this, I think, is just one of those events, and tragic as it is, and obviously the consequences for the families are terrible, but this is one of those moments in war. The strike in Damascus is more consequential and is probably taking up much more of the White House's bandwidth than the aid strike. You know, the real question now is, what does Iran do? Unless there's a massive wave of conversions to Christianity in Tehran and they decide to turn the other cheek, and I'm not predicting this, Iran is likely to respond in some form to what is really a real blow, a real military win for Israel, but also something that if Iran doesn't retaliate, it really reduces its prestige. It adds to the damage of the strike. Iran is going to do something. Now, what's Iran going to do? Is it going to attack? And again, the Iranians are looking, they'll want to do something that really hurts their enemies, but does not provoke an all-out war, which at the moment they still don't want to do. In fact, if the government of Iran and the Biden White House have anything in common, it's that neither one of them wants to see a war between Iran and the United States. So Iran's dilemma, to some degree, is if they really punch Israel hard in response to this, Israel is likely to punch back as hard or harder. If they punch the United States, there's actually a better chance that we will turn the other cheek and do something really quite mild in response. But then there is the danger that we might actually respond even more strongly. So the Iranians are trying to figure that out. I wish the Biden administration had simply said nothing about this strike. It shows weakness to say, oh, no, 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 it wasn't us. We had nothing. Oh, my goodness, we are innocent, innocent. It makes it look like you are quaking in your boots. That is the wrong signal to be sending at a time like this. I think much better to say we can neither confirm nor deny, et cetera, something along those lines. But I think if there's a real difference between Israeli interests right now and American interests as seen by the White House, it's that Israel probably wouldn't be that unhappy if the United States got into a war with Iran, while, you know, the United States absolutely doesn't want that. And this strike, which is clearly raising the odds that Iran would do something in response that would make it very, very hard for the U.S. to stay out of war, would be seen, I think, by the Biden White House as a much more offensive act by Israel than shooting a random aid convoy. You know, this is potential, unless in fact we did coordinate with the Israelis on the strike. This is, in essence, sort of an attack on American foreign policy by the government of Israel. So I would say if there is anything that is firing up anger in the Biden White House, it might be that. And at the same time, again, I don't think the aid convoy was on purpose, but the combination of the two puts huge PR pressure on the Biden people and huge policy pressure. So they're sweating it. We'll see what they do. So far, their pattern has been to try to look like they're doing something or might do something, but then do very little. I think they may have to go a little further down the road of doing something, but I think they'll be continuing to try to minimize what they do. We'll see.
All right. Final story of the week. About 8 in 10 voters in 7 swing states say fentanyl misuse is a very important or somewhat important issue when deciding who to vote for in November, more than the number who cite abortion, climate change, labor and unions, or the wars in Ukraine and Gaza, according to a recent Bloomberg News poll. From November 2019 to October 2023, about 270,000 Americans died of an overdose from a synthetic opioid. Those fatalities account for the vast majority of overall opioid overdose deaths, which have climbed to about 80,000 a year. For comparison, John Ellis of News Items pointed out that between 1964 and 1975, roughly 58,300 members of the U.S. Armed Forces were killed or went missing in action in the Vietnam War. Walter, news or faux news?
Oh, it's absolutely news. And it underscores the degree to which the policy discussions and perceptions of the, you know, American chattering classes are as divorced from the concerns of the average American as the gossip of the Court of Versailles was from the concerns of the average Frenchman in the 18th century. I suppose you could say a lot of us are running around playing like Marie Antoinette, organic farming, and you know, all of these like dressing up like shepherdesses, while in fact people are feeling, you know, the pain. The danger for the Biden people is that there's a connection between the fact that we have lost control of our southern border and that large amounts of illegal substances are popping up all over the United States. Now, in fact, it's very hard to stop imports of drugs. Remember at the start of the war on terror, somebody once said that if Al-Qaeda wanted to get a nuclear bomb into the United States, the best way to do it would be to hide it in a shipment of cocaine, because our rate of interdiction of cocaine was so low. But nevertheless, what's seen as simply a failure to care about this is devastating. Even in my family, we've had a young man die, and it seems to have been a case of a drug he was taking was laced with fentanyl, and it was fatal. This happens to lots of families across the country. And normally speaking, you would like to see that your government at least pretends to care about the things that matter to you. But we don't see that. It's news.
All right, that does it for the news this week. Let's have the big conversation. So in the wake of the IDF strike on Iranian military personnel in Syria this week, Walter, Iran has promised to retaliate maybe against Israeli targets, but as we discussed, maybe also against the U.S. People are worried that we could be implicated in retaliatory actions. There's also the ongoing crisis in the Red Sea, where the Biden administration has offered to possibly rescind the Houthis terrorist designation if they stop attacking ships. in Europe, Ukraine doesn't seem to be going particularly well with arms and manpower shortages and the Russian army and economy proving pretty resilient. You noted in a recent Wall Street Journal column that China is still pressing its advantages in the Indo-Pacific and the Western Hemisphere. Haiti and Sudan are in chaos. It's just not a lot of great, at least headline news these days. And in the background of all this, it's kind of hard to take your eye off the fact that as of this week, 7 months before the election, Donald Trump leads President Biden in 6 of the 7 battleground states. So it does seem like it's time to start thinking seriously about what foreign policy might actually look like in a second Trump term. And I know it's something you've thought about before, so I want to ask you about that. But before we get to it, I thought you could begin by giving us your grade for the Trump administration's foreign policy overall in its first term. What will the judge of history be there?
Incomplete. Things were not resolved. You can give him points for process. You know, no real new war started. Putin did not invade Ukraine, et cetera. You know, was that due to Trump or due to other things? It's very hard to say. Probably the single thing that has done the most damage to the United States and to President Biden was the absolutely chaotic and ham-fisted withdrawal from Afghanistan. And this was Trump's policy, too. You know, the Trump people will say, well, we would have done it much better. Frankly, they couldn't have done it much worse, but I don't know, you know, how much better it would have gone. In any case, if we look to the future, I think with Trump, you see a mix of things. I think his instincts about how the world works are actually significantly better than President Biden's, in the sense that Trump has a nose for power. An instinct for when he walks into a room, he reads power relations and he begins to maneuver in ways to put himself on the top of the power equation. Sometimes leads to behavior that people find disagreeable. But this may not be the worst way to look at a world in which you've got people like Kim Jong-un, Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin calling the shots. He's going to have the most trouble dealing with Europe. And maybe just let's talk about the difference between the Trump approach to Europe and the Biden approach to Europe, because I think it's one where, again, Trump actually, I think in some odd way, sees the world more clearly than Biden does. I think the Biden people really thought align closely with Germany. And, you know, the Germans are the solid center and we work with them. We can make things work, values, all of these great transatlantic things. And they think that the purpose of American foreign policy is to make the world progressively more and more like the European Union. And there are a lot of good things about that. More peaceful countries don't settle things with wars and so on. They institutionalize international relations. And to a very large degree, that's been a powerful part of what's animated American foreign policy since 1945, is the creation of a world ruled by law and anchored in the vision, the sort of vision of human rights, of democratic process, and all of these things that are so important to us domestically and in Europe as well. And I think the Biden people very much they're people in the administration who get that Asia is mattering more. But overall, and I think certainly for the president, there's a view that this is still what foreign policy needs to be about. Because what else is there? And the trouble is that beautiful as it is, and my heart is as bound up in this as anyone else's, it's just not on the cards. Europe as a political actor is too divided to really play a significant role in world affairs. The French have been kicked out of Africa. They've been unable to really assert themselves anywhere. They're sort of one power, the ability to regulate people doing business with them, which is not nothing, but I suspect actually a Trump administration might try to take that away. And economically, they are the slowest growing of the major centers of the world economy. And look, even in Germany, they look to be facing some very tough times coming up. Countries like India and China, even Turkey, closer into Europe, are simply not going that way, and we don't have any realistic prospect of making them go that way. So I think there's a sense in which the whole Biden approach is linked into kind of, you know, it's locked to a sinking ship, and that sinking ship is the Atlanticism of the 1940s. And Trump at least sees that that is not right. I'm not sure, you know, Trump thinks, I think, a little bit differently from you and me. And, you know, it's more, I've, you know, said to people, it's like, you see a pitcher who throws a curveball, probably can't do the calculus of the physics of the flight of the ball, but throws the curveball. That's Trump in foreign policy. Now, he doesn't just throw strikes, let me say. He throws a lot of other things too. But there is that view. So on Europe, Trump will simply not believe that getting Europe policy right is the heart of getting American policy right for the American foreign policy establishment. For most of the people in American journalism, this is unimaginable sacrilege. It's the end of the world. And yet it is correct. So I think there's an insight that Trump has that the current administration just doesn't. And on top of that, as I said, he's got a better feel for power, an instinct, a nose for power than the folks in there now. But there are a lot of other things. In a sense, you know, if you could, you would want to take more strategic concepts from Trump, and then you're instrumentalizing, and you want to hire people from the Biden administration to implement a lot of the policies that were being shaped by someone like Trump would be, from a foreign policy point of view, ideal. I don't know that we're going to get there. But implementation was, you know, there's no wall in Mexico. The Iran policy didn't get to where he wanted it to be. Maybe he started too late, maybe it would never work, et cetera. But this sort of whole business of using the government and agencies to put together a bunch of things. And so you're diplomats and you're treasury people and blah, and you're doing all of this while maintaining public support for it. I don't know. So what I think we do know is that a Trump administration will face absolutely determined, deep resistance from the bureaucracy, from the journalistic establishment. They'll face it when they're wrong, and they will be wrong about some things, but they'll also face it when they're right. And there'll be a lot of sort of self-dramatization. I am, you know, I'm La Résistance standing on the barricades of freedom because I think we need to be nicer to the EU and you don't. So it's not going to be a calm 4 years if Trump is president. But you know what? If Biden is reelected, I don't think it's going to be a calm 4 years either. I think we're headed into a storm. We're headed into a storm that, much to my sorrow, the Biden people do not yet really understand, I think, just what they're headed into. Almost all the assumptions they came into office with have turned out to be just flat wrong. Russia isn't parked. Iran isn't pacified. They haven't been able to build this kind of, you know, architecture with China that they thought they could build of contain, compete, cooperate. You know, the pieces aren't there. And in the absence of success, we're seeing a continued deterioration of the international security situation. So I don't actually know what to hope for. Put me among the undecided voters. I can remember enough problems from the first Trump administration. And of course, Jeremy, you're smiling, but you know, you were in the U.S. Embassy in Berlin during the first Trump administration. So I think
I remember it too.
I think you got a real earful on some days. And yet I look at what we've got now and I say, will 40 more years of this make things better? They won't, I'm afraid. So We are not in a good place as a country right now. And again, I think I'm going to be very interested to see what the American people choose to do this fall.
All right, that does it for the big conversation. Let's end on the tip of the week. Another reader request this week, Walter, this time from Carrie in New York, who wants to know your top three secretaries of state.
Oh, boy, top three. That's tough.
Carrie actually asked for your top five, but I thought that was too many, so I whittled it down.
In some ways, that would be easier. But you know, Philander Knox, I just want to give honorary mention to, because as far as I can tell, he's the one who said to President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, about the Panama Canal, "Oh, Mr. President, it'd be a shame if so great an accomplishment should be marred by even the slightest taint of legality." But, you know, I think historically it would be hard to say that John Quincy Adams would be anywhere but number the architect of the Monroe Doctrine. Then I think you've got to add Dean Acheson for his part. I mean, George Marshall, too. But actually, Acheson did a lot of the work when Marshall was Secretary of State. So I would put Dean Acheson in there. It gets a little tougher with number, Henry Kissinger, arguably, should be in that slot. Certainly in my lifetime, we haven't seen a Secretary of State dominate American policymaking and have as much impact on the world as Kissinger did. So those are probably my candidates.
All right, there you have it. Thanks to our producer, Noam Bloom. Thanks to Will Cummings at Hudson and my co-host, Walter Russell Mead. I'm Jeremy Stern. We'll see you next week. And until then, please go rate and review us. This helps other people find the show.